a few of these just to give background information. I think this is more for purposes of reading than anything else, but we would like to possibly highlight a few things for you just to indicate that there's a general trend, and that trend starts with Article 8 of the EU Directive. What is regarded as special personal information, and the question is how far can one deviate from it, and if you deviate from it, will it affect the adequacy status of a country? But in any event, so if we can get right into it, Mr. Chair, on page 1 to 5, we've got then extracts from the EU Directive, and maybe just to highlight, on page 2, paragraph 22 is of relevance. This is now an extract from the recitals of the EU Directive, so that would be of interest. And then also on the next page, page 3, recitals number 33, 34, 35, and 36. And I would like to possibly quote 36 quickly for you, Chair, because you will recall that where we... at the previous meeting of the technical committee, the committee asked whether it would be possible to expand on the special information with regard to a person's political opinions. So, recital number 36 then states, where in the course of electoral activities, the operation of the democratic system requires in certain member states that political parties compile data on people's political opinion, the processing of such data may be permitted for reasons of important public interest, provided that appropriate safeguards are established. So I think it's quite clear that at least from the recital at this stage, one would say that there is room to move with regard to that specific aspect discussed by the committee previously. On page 4 then, we have actually Article 8, of the EU Directive that deals with special categories of processing or processing of special personal information. And then first of all, important 8.1 then specifically indicates to us what will be regarded as special personal information, and that is information or personal data revealing a racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, trade union membership, and the processing of data concerning health or sex life. So that is just generally in fact then the requirement that member states will or shall prohibit the processing of special personal information or then data as it's called here. Paragraph 2, clause 2 is important, where it indicates to us that paragraph 1 shall not apply where. So the general rule, Mr. Chair, is there's a prohibition on the processing of personal information, and then we get to the exclusions or exemptions. 2A indicate that paragraph 1 shall not apply where the data subject has given his explicit consent, except where the member states provide otherwise, to the extent that in certain cases data subjects' consent may not lift that prohibition. And you will note, Mr. Chair, that that is one of the things that we do have, one of the requirements that we do have as an exemption under our Part B. 2B deals with the processing, where the processing is necessary for purposes of carrying out the obligation and specific rights of the controller in the field of employment law. We have similar provisions. Under C, processing is necessary to protect the vital interests of the data subject or another person, where the data subject is physically or legally incapable of giving his consent. And then in D, processing is carried out in the course of legitimate activities with appropriate guarantees by a foundation, your political and philosophical and religious bodies, on the condition that the processing relates solely to the members of the body or to persons who have regular contact with that body. And then also very important that the data may not be disclosed to a third third party if the data subject does not consent to such disclosure. Those are still the provisions that we do have largely in our poll. Paragraph E provides that the processing relates to data which are manifestly made public by the data subject or is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of legal claims. Paragraph 3 provides that the first paragraph shall not apply when the processing of the data is required for purposes of preventative medicine, medical diagnostics, etc. So that is the health information. And then, Mr. Chair, you will recall that we've indicated with regard to political activities that in the recital there's already a provision or indication that member states or other states may go a bit further. And here we have it in 8.4. Subject to the provision of suitable safeguard, member states may, for reason of substantial public interest, once again, lay down exemptions in addition to those laid down in paragraph 2. So those are the sort of general exemptions, if I may call that, either by national law or then by decision of the supervisory authority. And then 8.4 deals with the processing of data relating to offences, criminal convictions and security measures. And then possibly just to indicate, well, paragraph 6 and 7 is strictly speaking, well, paragraph 6 is not strictly speaking applicable to the Republic because it provides that derogations from paragraph 1 provided for in 4 and 5. Those are the criminal offences and the political opinions in our example. This shall be notified to the Commission. So, Chair, in short, that is the EU directive and specifically Article 8 as far as special personal information is concerned. On page 6 and further, we've made extracts from two European... Sorry, Chair, I'm going to be interrupted now by my colleague.
Perhaps we can just give a sort of a summary of this, just to see what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. I think that the directive gives the opportunity, actually in 8.1, the directive actually tells you what the prohibition should be. And you can also include other issues. For instance, in other countries, sometimes they include credit information or they include bank details or things like that. So you can have a stricter position than the one that they have here, but I think these are more or less the minimum requirements. It is always possible to deviate from this, and you will see when we discuss the other countries as well and the evaluations done by the EU Article 29 Committee, is that they do allow deviations of this, and especially we can have a look at Israel and so forth. But when you do that, then you must have very good motivation, because you start getting into trouble. You must really have good reasons why you have deviated from, if you have not included some of these instances. So if you decide to leave out religious beliefs, for instance, you will have to then explain exactly why you did that, and they will evaluate that. But it's not so easy. But the minimum requirements are put in here, and you can have, it's no problem if you want to include anything. I think Henk has mentioned to me that he thought that we may include, for instance, cultural with religious and philosophical beliefs, because it's a little bit different, and it may be in South Africa a good idea to do that. He will perhaps present that argument to you later. So that's insofar as the prohibition is concerned. Then you usually have the derogations, as they are called in the EU directive, which we call our exceptions or exemptions. And they are, again, you are allowed to go wider than they are. So you can use the prohibition as is, or you can make it stricter. The opposite is true of the derogations. The derogations are there, but you can be more lenient. So if you want to include, and that's where 8.4 comes in, if you want to have exemptions that go wider than the ones that are indicated here, then that's possible, because 8.4 makes provision for that. So you do have some leeway in that regard. The prohibition is always there. You can have wider derogations than they have in this. That's just a point that I would have wanted to make.
Thank you, Chair. Chairman, just as for my taste, I'm sorry for being picky, but can we avoid utilizing expression like leeway? I mean, this is not a directive unto us. Thank you, Chair. It's indeed not a directive applying to us, but there's a number of considerations that must have regard to, among others, cross-border flow of information. If South Africa, for example, contracts with a country like Germany and they are subject to the EU directive, by implication, if one would like to provide the guarantee of adequate safeguards, we should, to a certain extent, not regard ourselves as subject to it, but it is an extremely important guiding tool for us. If I may, because this is an important issue in our deliberations, the adequacy test is a complex test. We could achieve adequacy by contracts. We wouldn't need this legislation. Sure, this is the best way of achieving immediate adequacy. But I just want to, as I've done in the past, not create this perception that we need to comply with a EU directive, which is not what this parliament is in the position of having to do.
I don't think it's worth carrying on the debate. I mean, I think it's generally quite clear. We're a sovereign country. We pass our own laws. We're not a member of the EU. However, for the purposes of international trade, which is important, we don't want to have problems of countries not being prepared to exchange or trade exchange information with us because of a lack of compliance with their internal requirements. But I don't think the place is, I mean, we will get to a point where we have to evaluate is this going to be compliant/consistent with the EU, but we're not at that point at this stage.
May I just approach on this, because this has been one of the things that concerns me about. There are two sides to this proposition. The one is that of opening ourselves to a greater measure of facilitation of trade towards those countries which do have a regulatory environment similar to the one that we're about to implement. And that's a plus. The other one is to impose on ourselves the restriction by virtue of legislation we adopt, in terms of which we are not to trade in respect of the same subject matter wherever informations are involved with all those countries which do not have the same the same regulatory framework in place. So we are on the one hand increasing, on the other hand imposing a self-limitation on the very same subject on which we are imposing whom we are facilitating in their trading. And some, and this is not a discussion for now, but it's been raised somewhere, somehow. I feel the need of developing an awareness of how much are we constraining our trade. For instance, in respect of countries like China, which doesn't seem to have such regulations in terms of trading information there, or India, or other potential partners in the south-to-south channel of trading, or trading, which is an emerging one.
The point is not the stage, I mean, to debate it. Okay, Ananda.
Very shortly, just one line. The thing is that if we have the legislation, we will be in a better position insofar as those countries, and there are 50 plus, I think there are even more, that already have the legislation. So it will be easier for us to trade with Europe, for instance, and so forth. The position with regard to the countries that don't have the legislation will just be the status quo. So we won't be in a worse position.
But look, sorry, can we not have this debate now? We're not dealing with that aspect. We'll deal with it at a later point when we're closer to finalizing. Okay, I think Henk, you were on the floor. Just one question, what's the relationship between the first paragraphs, the sort of one to 37, I mean, you've taken out certain pages that are relevant to us. What's the relationship between that and the principles?
Yeah, I'm going to start answering, and then I think Ms. Lowe would like to add something there. But those are called recitals, like, for example, which we can compare to preambles and object clauses, our own legislation. So it is, to a certain extent, it aims to provide background information to the provisions themselves and to possibly provide better explanation of the content of the articles. I don't know whether Ananda would like to add something. I think
it just seems odd that you've got two separate documents. So, for example, number 36 is particularly valid. The issue that we were concerned about of political parties compiling data, and it's not exactly the same as which one is it? It's not exactly the same as what is in Article 8. So why didn't they put it into Article 8 is basically the issue for me.
I think, well, it's one document. It's just the introduction to the document, and we've just not added all the pages. You know, there are pages in between, but it's one document. And I think it is the same, because it's actually 8.4 just says that you may lay down exemptions in addition to those laid down in paragraph 2. Now, I think that would be one of the examples.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, then our next few or two is relates to the UK and the Netherlands. I don't think it's necessary to take too much time with the Netherlands, maybe just to register the fact that if you look at our part B, it is to a certain extent a mirror image of what is contained here. They've also started on page 7, Article 16, with the general prohibition or the act indicating what will be regarded as special personal information. Then the following clauses or articles deal in similar fashion, like our proposed Part B, with specific issues of health, a person's religion, philosophy, for example, in Article 17, a person's race, in Article 18, and then political persuasions, Article 9, etc. And then in Article 23, which is also then once again similar to the clause 32 contained in the introduced version of the bill, is then sort of a general exemption provided with regard to the processing of special personal information. Page 11 is the UK example. I don't think we need also to waste too much time here, maybe just to once again register that in Article 2 they have their definition of what sensitive personal data is, and it is, to a large extent, it follows the EU and our approach with regard to special personal information is then once again similar. On page 13, you have the general prohibition that data shall not be processed unless, in the case of sensitive personal data, at least one of the conditions in Schedule 3 is also met. And then if you turn to page 14, we have Schedule 3, which then indicates under which circumstances the information may be processed then. Chair, on page 16, just a page before that, we have a short summary of third countries that have been evaluated by the EU for purposes of adequacy as far as the processing of special personal information is concerned. And I think what we can possibly do is, after we've gone through this document, maybe just to quickly come back to this. But it gives us a general indication of the different countries and the rating as far as special personal information is concerned. possibly of interest at this stage, one could, because we're going to get to Australia, and we actually used that example as well in our document. But interestingly enough, in Australia, the conclusion was the Australian Privacy Act 1988 predates the EU directive. It was amended in 2000 to apply to the private sector as well, but the two sectors are dealt with separately. The extracts from the amended section did not receive adequacy status. The reason for that was that they used collection, the term collection, and not processing in their section 10. So they limited their special information to collection only, and that was mainly the reason why they didn't get adequacy on that score. So it is interesting just maybe to note at this stage.
As far as
the processing of personal special information is concerned, we will see that the working party raised the whole bill, if I may say so, or go through the whole bill. But as far as special personal information is concerned, it was limited to collection. Mr. Chair, page 16 is Argentina, pages 16 to 18. Page 16 and 17 provides us at the bottom of page 16 with the definition of sensitive data, and it's once again information that reveal a racial, ethnic origin, political opinions, religious, philosophical, or moral beliefs, labor union membership, and information concerning health conditions or sexual habits or behavior. So once again, just that list reflected in the EU directive. And then on page 18, we do have the provision that deals with sensitive data. I don't know whether it's really necessary to go through the clause by clause. The information is there, and one could have a look at that. Section 8 then also deals with health-related data. On page 19, Mr. Chair, then,
just that, perhaps to facilitate this exercise, you've gone through all these. They all seem basically to relate to the same type of classes of information. Is there any deviance, any differentiation that you would wish to bring up our attention, or are they all the same?
I think they are more or less the same insofar as the definition of sensitive data is concerned, and also they all have a prohibition that you're not allowed to deal with it in some or other way. The difference really is, and I think that's the decision that will have to be taken by the committee, is whether the committee would like it to be a comprehensive, a very comprehensive sort of section, such as the one in the Netherlands that we followed and the one that we have, or whether one should, because I think if you look at Argentina, for instance, it's very short. I mean, they only have the definition, and then they have these four, actually five, if you include the health-related data. That's what they do. So it's more in the line of a sort of a generic section. And that's really what you would have to decide. But that was also rated as adequate. So it's not necessary to have a very comprehensive section. However, if you deal with it more comprehensively, it's clearer. I mean, it gives people a better indication of what they're allowed to do or not allowed to do and so forth. And many countries, actually, I would say the majority of them actually have the extended explanation dealing with the derogations in great detail. So it will also be interesting to see, to look at, for instance, at Israel, which they have just received adequacy, and also to perhaps start understanding how the EU actually looks at these, how they evaluate it, because with the instance of Israel, for instance, they took into consideration the fact that it is a common law country and also the court cases and so forth, but they received the adequacy in terms of 25.6, which is not the same as 25.1, and it means that at first they were regarded as being inadequate and they had to produce more information and explanations and so forth, which they did, referring to all of these things like the common law and the the court cases and so forth, and on the basis of sort of the holistic picture, they actually then approved their act as well. So that's how it works. But the decision really will have to be whether we would like to deal with it comprehensively, each derogation on its own, as it has been done in the first one, or whether we would like to summarize it and just have a sort of a very wide open. So that's something that you can have a look at when you look at the legislation.
Okay, but carry on please. But I think obviously, as Dr. Ambrosini has said, point out in the international comparisons, I mean, to summarize how a country has done it and then where they've deviated from or done it differently to another country or to the way that we had it proposed originally.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, honestly, it's a general trend. I don't know, at least we know what the structure of the document is. It's very useful because it also indicates to us how the working party approaches the evaluation as far as special personal information is concerned. There's not really something that I can think of now that I can really indicate to the committee which is staggeringly different in any country.
Without prejudice to the section 7 types of data, without prejudice to the foregoing, the Catholic Church, religious associations, and political and labour organisations shall be entitled to keep a register of their members. Anyway.
I think, honestly, I don't know whether we still need to labour this matter, but it's extremely important and valuable for us to have this document because it provides an extremely helpful comparison. The Seychelles, maybe I could draw your attention to one aspect, and that is on page 82, the processing of sensitive personal data. This is, yes, Chair. Now, that is Mauritius. It starts on page 80. 81, we once again have our definition of sensitive personal data. The interesting one, Chair, is in section 25.2a, Roman 3. So, in other words, in 25.1, they have the general prohibition, no sensitive personal data shall be processed unless the data subject has given express consent or made the information public. And then in sub 2, it provides that subsection 1 shall not apply where the processing is necessary. And then in Roman 1, this is the one aspect that is interesting, that they added, if I may say so, that their example is a bit different from what we've seen in other countries as well as in ours, to the extent that the processing, in other words, the prohibition in 25.1 shall not apply if the processing is necessary, and then Roman 3 on page 22, in order to protect the vital interest of another person in a case where consent by or on behalf of the data subject has been unreasonably withheld. That is something new that we haven't seen in other cases.
Give us a situation that would refer to.
Pick a foreign chair.
Give us an example of where that would refer to.
Maybe we could just note this one now, because when we get to our provision, we'll.
So basically, do the chairman.
And somehow differentiates from Article 8 to C, right? In that 2C basically say when it's legally incapable of giving consent, and this would add legally incapable or terribly stubborn, right? No, I'm relating to Article 8 of the European Convention, your Bible there, as it relates to the Article 8 sub 2 sub C, which refers to there is legal incapable, physically or legal incapable. So here is physically legal incapable or bloody minded, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, okay, listen, I think it's...
I see Mauritius doesn't have a health provision, so, but anyway, you've said that you'll come back to it, but the only situation I can think of at the moment is a health one where it's a notifiable disease and the person won't allow him consent for that information that they've got this notifiable disease to be processed. But anyway, we can come back to it.
Well, I'm not getting anything from friends. Usually, they're quite good in implementing these things.
Are you asking France?
Yes.
It's in French.
So is Senegal, yes, Tunisia, Morocco, and many of us can read French.
France is just another European country, and they follow the EU directly. You know, so having a lot of those examples, the Netherlands, and so we try to get the African countries that we know that have legislation. So that's why we included them, even if they were in French. I would just like to draw your attention.
No, just out of interest with French, I mean, you've looked at the French, or you can read French.
I can read it very. Very little. But I can follow it. Even you will be able to follow it because it's exactly the same. You can see, the words are more or less the same. Okay. So you can see that you can't actually, follow that. Well, okay. I can't. We'll forget some of it. On 52, it's just interesting in Israel, the definition of sensitive information, there they said data on the personality, intimate affairs, state of health, economic position, opinions and beliefs of a person. Now that was also regarded by the EU as substantially the same. So it's not necessary to follow it exactly as it is, but you have to include the basic principles or whatever. This definition of sensitive information, although it's not exactly the same as the one that they agreed on, is they took it as meaning more or less the same.
All right. So those are the international comparisons that you've given us. I mean, why did you have the Faroe Islands? I'm not even sure where they are. I mean, what is the relevance?
They've
of
also been. They actually have adequate status.
Are they?
No,
to answer that one for you, by way of referring you to the provision of this extract from the Act on page 42, because it's sometimes interesting how these things boggle the mind, where is this country or whatever, but I can give you a clue at the most cheap. And that is that if you look on page 43, they define foreign countries as Denmark and Greenland. Be close in that region.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it is a pity that there aren't more developing countries. You have put the Francophone countries, but one suspects that they would probably all be the same. I mean, that generally tends to be quite a Francophone line that's followed. But okay, I mean, if anybody else has any ideas of any other developing countries that have tackled this, let us know. Okay, then, do you want to then proceed to the amendments that you're proposing?
Yes, do.
So you'll now be going into the document. Everybody, I think, by now has got.
Yes, and it is a 9-page document. On the first page, it indicates to us that it's a working draft that I slide on part B of chapter 3. What we did on page 2, we just selected a few definitions which we thought might be useful when we take a look at this part. So we just merely repeated them here. So that a reference to them where necessary is easier. On the next page, Chair, and I need to... Mr. Chair, on page 2, we have definitions that we decided to insert here merely as a source of a reference, where...
The definitions that crop up in the rest of the section. Just taken out the definitions to help us that will be covered in the preceding clauses.
On page 3, Chair, and I need to take you quickly back to the previous meeting of the technical committee. We were requested to insert information in clause 25 of the bill as introduced, and that was mainly a reference to genetic data. But then what we have under 25A was our general exemption clause that was or is reflected in clause 32 of our introduced version of the bill. We were requested to consider whether it wasn't possible to bring clause 32, which is at the end of part B, to the front of this part to make it a bit more clearer. Then you will see that there is underlining under the proposed 25A. That is, you will also recall, and we do have a footnote to that extent, that the Nelson Mandela Foundation submitted comments to the extent that the processing of special personal information for historical, statistical, or scientific research purposes should also be regarded as part of a general exemption provision. You will recall that we have conceded that in the summary to the comments, and we have decided to propose to include that in the clause as well. And then
finish the clause?
Yes, Chair, thank you. And then in paragraph G, we have a reference to the provisions of sections 26 to 31. So in other words, Mr. Chair, where we had our general exemption provision in clause 32, it is proposed now that it becomes a clause that follows the prohibition on the processing of special personal information, and then the insertion of paragraph G provides us with an indication that the provisions of the general exemption apply, and if not, or then you refer to the specific provisions which are contained in clauses 26 to 31. The part B on page 4 is sort of an extension, Chair, of what we have under part A, and maybe I could just quickly run through that as well for you. You will see that we have decided to drop underlining because it becomes a bit confusing to read it. So where we have double spacing in this document, it is something entirely, well, not entirely new, but a different approach to be proposed. If you compare, for example, on page 4, the clause 25 with the provisions of clause 25 under A, then you will note a substantial difference to the extent that we propose that in order to clarify the position of children better, Mr. Chair, we propose that then in a subclause 1 to clause 25, we should refer to the fact that a responsible party may, subject to section 25A, which is then the general exemption clause, not process the personal information concerning a child who is subject to parental control in terms of the law. And then in sub 2, to distinguish the position of other data subjects from children, then we say that, or we propose that a responsible party may then, subject to Section 25A or Sections 26 to 31, as the case may be, not process the personal information concerning, and then we define our sensitive personal information. So the prohibition is that processing may not take place subject to either the general exemption or the exemptions provided in Sections 26 to 31. And then the only difference between the proposed 25A under paragraph B on page 4 and the 25A under paragraph A on page 3 is that we try to draw a better distinction once again between the processing of the special personal or the information of children and then the special personal information of other people. The 25A will then read, or it's proposed to read, that the prohibition on processing of personal information as referred to in section 25A, 25.1 or 2, does not apply if the processing is carried out with A, the prior consent in respect of a parental consent in respect of a child referred to in subsection section 25.1, or then the consent of a data subject referred to in section 25.2. Then the rest is identical to what we have on page 3, except then a minor change with regard to G. G then indicates to us that if the processing, insofar as section 25.2 is concerned, in other words, all data subjects except children, where the information has been deliberately made public by the data subject, or the provisions of sections 26 to 31 are complied with. Then, on page 5 to 7, we have the provisions of the bill as they were as introduced in the introduced version, with certain proposed amendments which transpired from the previous meeting of the technical committee. On page 5, the important one is then of course the proposed amendment with regard to clause 26, the religious or philosophical beliefs, in order to see whether one could extend the ambit beyond members of those organizations. You will recall that under the political provision, the request was also made that we should try and find and see whether it is possible to extend the ambit of that clause beyond members only. So at the bottom of page 5, under clause 29, we have the exemption concerning a data subject's political persuasion, so the provision will remain the same. But then on page 6, we propose, Chair, and we just merely call it an option 1 just to provide you with an indication of what our thinking is at this stage, is that we extend the ambit of that clause under a proposed new subclause 1B, that the processing of personal information, the general prohibition will not apply if such processing is necessary for purposes of forming a political party, participating in the activities or engaging in the recruitment of members for a political party with the view to an election of the National Assembly or the provincial legislature as regulated in terms of the Electoral Act of 1998, or then municipal elections as regulated in terms of the Local Government Municipal Electoral Act of 2000, or a referendum as regulated in terms of the 1983 Referendums Act. And then finally, which is also the broader provision, then whether where there is campaigning for a political party or a cause. I don't know whether I should pause at this stage, Chair, maybe just to indicate that the rest remain the same under Clause 31, the exemption concerning the data subject's criminal behaviour. The technical committee also questioned what the term criminal behaviour entails, and you will see at the bottom then of Clause 31 a proposed new subclause 5 based on Section 2G and H of the UK Act, where we propose then to insert that definition. And then finally, Chair, at the previous meeting of the Technical Committee, we were also requested to provide a provision or an option which deals or which is based on the Australian Act. And that is reflected on page 8 and 9. I don't know whether it's necessary to go into detail immediately, but maybe just to refer you to the fact that we've earlier said that as far as their special personal information is concerned, Australia didn't get the adequacy rating because they restricted it to collection, which we didn't do here. That's the one aspect. And the other aspect is, when we go through it in more detail, Chair, the other concern that we have at this stage is, although it is based on the Australian Act and we try to stick to the example as closely as possible, there are other provisions in our introduced version of Part B which are not covered at this stage in this proposal.
We should then start from the top. So I think then can we look then at obviously A, B and C all fit together, but the specific clauses 26 to 31, let's look at 25 and 25A. That would be an A and B. Who wants to start, Dean?
Just one note on the children. Would I be correct in saying that the EU nowhere deals with children? I nevertheless think it's a good idea that we should introduce such a thing, but perhaps we need to do some more thinking about what other effect we need to give. What I want to ask about is this. The inclusion of genetic data. At my request. You've included it with health information, and I think that we need to think through A, whether we've done enough, and B, whether genetic data only in the sphere of health is what we're concerned with, and whether we ought not to look at its use or abuse in crime prevention and the administration of justice. If we're saying genetic health, it is now prohibited to process genetic data as part of a person's health. Then we go from there to the clause on health or sexual life, where we find under 31B that insurance companies, amongst others, are exempted from the requirement for privacy when they assess the risk to be insured by the insurance company. Now, do we want that? Do we want insurance companies to be free to look at people's genetic mapping and to assess their genetic predispositions and their likely health and their likely lifespan? I mean, it's a science that is developing very fast, but it is new. And is that appropriate? Your genetic data is your most personal and your most private data. Should an insurance company be in a position to read your genetic mapping and to decide that you have certain health risks and therefore construct their
business with you accordingly. Is that right?
I mean, remember the health, yeah, just before and under, the health, the insurance companies, I mean, you approach them on a voluntary basis. So it's part of the package. You want health insurance from company A. Company A then says, in order to assess whether you whether we give you health insurance or not, you must meet the following criteria, supply us with the following information. So you don't have to supply it, and then you don't have to continue with the application. We did raise last time, remember, I think it was in the context of hotel information, I think, Dr. Ambrosini, that you that hotels shouldn't have be able to ask you, what was it, Mario, everything in sight for what you had, where you were going. There's the issue of the cell phone credit providers wanting your bank records for the last 3 months, you know, that you shouldn't have to actually, they shouldn't be allowed to ask that. So I think it's a question of whether we should restrict insurance companies from asking for that information at all. That's the question. And that's I mean, the difficulty is it's a whole different industry, which if we start taking a position on is going to have far-reaching consequences that we may not even know about. I mean, I'm sure the insurance companies would say, well, it increases their risk and then makes it unprofitable for them. But as you say, genetic mapping is developing. I mean, in terms of, I was listening to some stuff on the radio, the ability to the debate around whether genetic analyzing your genes can help you with dieting, what foodstuffs to avoid, and whether that's possible now or it's not, but it will be soon, even if it's not now. But Anandi wanted to say something, but I mean, I don't know. For me, the issue is I don't know whether we can restrict insurance companies from asking for that information. Obviously, the party, the data subject, can refuse to supply that information, in which case the insurance company can then turn around and say, well, we're not then going to take you on. And then the other one, though, is that, and maybe it's an easier one, maybe deal with it first. Why is genetic data included under health? Is health including genetic data? Can we deal with that one first, because I think it's easy.
Yes.
Why is it health, not health, comma, genetic data, sexual life?
Yeah.
Why have you got it as health including genetic
and
data?
Let me just address you on the criminal aspect after Ananda.
Chairman, before the response is given, let me step back because I think some confusion has been made between two aspects. This bill does not deal with what can and cannot be asked of a person. This bill deals with what people do with information they obtain from a person. It is my strong and echoing submission to this committee that we must have one article which deals with the right to privacy and will deal with what can be asked or asked of a person. And I've repeatedly given a proposed language for an amendment which basically states that no one should be required to answer to provide information which is not relevant to the conduct of a transaction as a condition for the transaction to be finalized. If I go to the hotel and I'm contracting to buy a room, they don't need to know where I am coming from and where I intend to go to. If I buy a car, they don't need to know where I live, etc., etc. But if I buy insurance company, it is relevant for them to acquire and information available to the to my health, and genetic information is how health is going to be assessed in the future. As in the past, people used to do so through a blood test, which was a picture of now. Genetic inform- information. It's a picture of before, now, and the future. So, but the important thing is to assert the right to privacy, to close the curtains onto people looking beyond what they are entitled to know for the purpose of the transaction they enter into and collect data which they are not in, they have no right to have in the first place. So that's my approach to the second point. On the first point, yes, I agree, genetic data is not health data. It's iris reading, fingerprinting, you name it, there will be, there are even smell detectors now that are being, that basically can recognize genetic data released in the air, in the hair, the same way as my German Shepherd can do, recognize people by smell. So it's, I do agree, it should be a separate category.
Okay, just trying to get some order, even though it's a few people. There've been general comments. I don't know if you want to give a general response, and then can we get on to the question of including genetic data and the wording. Christina, had your hand up as well. I think, Dean, you want to get on to
I just wanted to pick up from Mario now, because otherwise we...
Is it general or is it on?
No, it's flowing directly from what he said. And it supports the view that I don't think that this should be limited to health, necessarily. Because the other aspect, don't let's forget, is the criminal justice aspect, where we've had the Marfa judgment in the European Court, which related to the retention of biological samples. And we must draw a distinction, Mario, between the biometric and the DNA. That is certainly the way that our colleagues in the police committee are going. We're dealing now with the idea of the retention of people's biometric and genetic samples. Yes, but the question is whether we're dealing with the issue whether you limit it to health or whether you state. No, we haven't talked about it.
You wanted to say something, but I'd like to hear before we take a final decision why did you put it in as including, I mean, under health. But Christine, you what's your point?
No, I was just wondering, is it necessary to define genetic data? Because okay. There's nothing here that.
All right.
I think I would agree that it's not health including genetic information. It can be you can read political opinions, health, genetic data, sexual life, or criminal behavior. I think that is fine. But I am wondering whether it wouldn't still be possible to include it under 30, exemption concerning data subject to health, genetics, or sexual life. Because the exemption actually deals with a lot of things. It doesn't only deal with the medical professionals, which genetic data sometimes refer to. But it also deals with schools, any other institutions, the Minister of Correctional Services, administrative bodies, pension funds, employers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it goes on until 6. So it will actually fit in well with 30, the exemption. We can perhaps check it and see if there aren't other issues that should be included. But I would agree to it in the definition, or not the definition, the first 25, in 25, that be included. I don't know what Henka feels about it, but I think that is a good point, that it should be separate, but then still be included in the exemption, subject to us perhaps just going through it to see whether it should be, there is something else that we would like to include there.
First, we can come back to that. I mean, I'm not sure. You are then taking it as health, whereas it's more identification issues that I think people are concerned about. But can I just get an answer? Why in the amendment that you've got have you got it under health? So let's look at 25. Why do you have health including genetic data rather than it as a specific category? Because I think the issue is quite clear that. Genetic information can be used for identification purposes. It can have nothing to do with health. And you're restricting it to health here. Why is that?
Chair, we were concerned to the extent that we wanted to attach genetic data to Clause 30 as easy as possible, because we were precisely concerned of unintended consequences. And of course, it may become necessary to define genetic data, because genetic data can be considered as part of a person's health, but if you go beyond that, then I think we might have to become much more clearer by defining that. We do have a definition of biometric information in Clause 1, but that does not deal... Yes. So, to a certain extent, we considered it appropriate to attach it to health information. But that's not to say that it's limited to genetics for purposes of health. It could be read and interpreted that you regard, for purposes of law study, genetic information as part of your health information, because it makes the drafting down there easier. The concern is, should one provide for a specific provision, or can it still be attached to law study?
What is the difference between genetic information and DNA analysis?
I think we define biometric as a technique of personal identification that's based on physical characteristics, including fingerprinting, DNA analysis, retinal scanning, and voice recognition. That's what generally is accepted as being biometric. So I don't know, we thought that would include genetics as well, because your genetics are being determined by your DNA, isn't it? So DNA analysis, we thought, included genetics. That was the thinking at the time.
You've effectively, I mean, does anybody else here know anything on this topic? Dean?
All I know is what I've read really in the Marpa judgment, and I have one colleague, Wilmot James, who keenly interested in this. But don't forget that you can do things with DNA samples that you can't do with fingerprints and retina. It's not just an identification tool. The entire difficulty and danger of DNA is that it is misused for familial searching, and so people suddenly discover that they are directly related to persons of whom they have no idea. It is used for ethnic profiling. It holds such dangers. That is what I know from the European judgment. And I think it probably requires a little more thought. And we may indeed have to go in the direction of a specific provision, but then we would be breaking new ground.
I mean, I see what you've done is you've effectively tried to divide the identification parts into the, by putting DNA analysis into the biometric definition, and then kept genetic as a health-related issue. But I think it would point to the fact that I mean, I think following on from what Dean has said, that it is not really a category on its own, because it's wider than that. I'm also not sure whether genetic data and DNA sampling are the same. I just don't know. DNA analysis are the same. And part of the problem is it is developing all the time. But I think the question really is, should genetic data not be a category on its own? Because it has these different usages. So you may have your data been taken, and you get told, even though you didn't give consent, that you are going to have a heart attack at the age of 27, which you have the right not to know. Or you may have your genetic data taken and find that you are related to Dr. Ambrosini, which may be equally shocking. Surely what are other countries doing about this? I mean, surely somebody else must have looked at this.
I wonder, Chair, if I can just come here. You know, like something that they sometimes use is by referencing the term biological information, which I think is a much clearer definition than genetic data. Because biological information is anything from blood samples, DNA, whatever the case might be. And then when you go, like, for instance, for drunken driving and they collect blood, so then you also have to have it under certain other instances apart from health information.
Okay, but I think, can we look at it, because, you know, was it in America or was it Britain where they were doing random, I mean, it's the whole debate which is actually more, well, it's to some extent with us as justice, but it's also with police, you know, when you can take the, I don't know, biological data, whatever, of suspects, and I think they found that they were targeting particular categories of people, race groups. I think it was America. And as a, was it UK? Okay, as a way of getting them into the database, and therefore trumping up some idea to arrest them on suspicion of having committed a crime. But can we look at that? I don't know about the I did biology up till matric. After that, it ended. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, it sure, biological data seems wider, but. Given all the usages of DNA, is that the best place for it to go? And then also that this needs to be a expanding clause, is it, or a clause that's capable of dealing with a new technology, which will be coming out as the months, if not years, roll by. So can we agree on this aspect that the legal advisors should look specifically at this aspect, that more work needs to be done on that, in particular with international comparisons? The idea would be basically a concern that all genetic data, biological information, biometric, I don't know what you call it, DNA analysis, that there should be protection and safeguards for that information. Ananda?
I think that everybody's in agreement that it's very sensitive information and that therefore it should be included somewhere here. The Australian Law Reform Commission has done a very comprehensive investigation on specifically on DNA and this whole area. So it will be fairly easy to get the most recent, it was about 2 years ago. So it's,
but at this stage, we're not, I think it would be fair to say, we're not particularly happy with genetic data being included under health, because we feel it's wider. Although there may be, well, look, I don't know, I mean, the issue of, yeah, there may be specific aspects that maybe do fit under there, having, I'm not contradicting myself, but, Okay. Can we then move to clause 25A? The difference is that under where it was, it required the, what's been dropped is the regulator. That does apply under D, the regulator's granted authority, but the rest of it can just happen. Whereas under the old 34, the regulator had to give permission for the processing. Now, if you look at the research aspect, it is now allowed, but maybe requiring the regulator to give permission for research to be conducted was hopelessly impractical.
Jay, you must please excuse me, but I'm a bit confused now. Are you comparing the 225As with each other?
Yeah, I think he's concentrating on the historical statistical scientific research subsection.
Are we looking at 25A versus 34?
But it's
So we're just seized with 25A, right?
Okay, but it does relate to, we can come back to it later, the historical, statistical or research activity,
what
was a requirement that the regulator gives permission.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can read it. Can we discuss 25A now?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have a view on where things should be. I think the more we move around, the more we complicate things. The position and the act is irrelevant. But on the actual content, first of all, I don't understand this G. I mean, it was right the way it was before. I think without prejudice to section, I mean, it's not... Without prejudice is the wrong expression. Be subject to section. Well, perhaps, yeah, without section, because all the G is saying is the provision of section 29 or 31 apply, not comply with, because there are exceptions. Then on the F,
Can we just stop there, Mario? Can we just deal with that aspect that you've raised?
Okay,
why the move from without prejudice to G?
Okay, it's language. It's what we're trying to say here, G, that if the provision... 26 and 31 are exceptions. Sorry, 26 and 31.
Mario, I hear you. We have a response from them why they changed.
Okay, can I just give them a chance? I'm sure they can handle a couple of questions at the time. Do you mind? Then the... on F, more...
No, I want to deal with this. F is separate. Sorry.
Okay,
you
know,
you
we'll
can
never
have
finish.
Can we get clarity why you moved without prejudice or the references to section 26 to 31 from a introduction at 25 to the separate sub G?
We must remember that. It's a really difficult question to answer, but it's technical. Our clause, this was the wording of our clause 32. So, in other words, it indicated to us that the provisions of section 26 to 31 stand, but if the provisions of 32 apply, then that is also fine. What we've proposed now is to make it simply more clear. We do not regard it as any substantive deviation from what we had in clause 32 to that extent, but to indicate merely that as far as a general exemption is concerned, you have your paragraphs A to F, including then paragraph G. In other words, that the prohibition on the processing of personal information as referred to in section 25 applies in six or seven different circumstances, the six being a general exemption and the seventh then the provisions as they are reflected in clauses 26 to 31.
Ms. Mutz, as a non-lawyer, which one do you prefer?
Yeah, the only things that bother me are simple grammar.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
In your second one, for example, the word "with" at the end of your first sentence should be inserted before A. It's little, say little things, and for the rest, no, I don't have a particular preference.
Okay. Look, let's. I don't know if we can make a decision at this point. I mean, let's think about it. Mario, do you want to then go on to F?
Yes, thank you. Now, moving to matter of greater substance. I'm in agreement with F, but I want to have, I suggest strongly, firmly, that the end should be an or after Roman 3, because otherwise it's absurd. It really makes no sense. Why one would want to need to meet all four requirements? I mean, if something is in the public interest, that's fine. You're out of it. You're exempt. If the processing is necessary for the research concerned, then it's sufficient. But to be in the public interest and must be in the interest of the research, necessary for the research concerned, it would be impossible and you need to meet all four requirements. It really makes the exemption so tight, almost to become meaningless.
I don't agree on that one. I mean, this is processing of personal information. It should be onerous requirements. Dean, do you have anything on that one? I mean, before, just then, this thing with this cross-rep or the similarity with 34.2e, regulator may authorize. I mean, what was the regime before that you had to get permission from the regulator to process, to conduct historical statistical or research? I mean, which seems very onerous on the regulator.
I think the new if was actually the way it was in the draft of the discussion paper that we sent out. It was taken out because people thought that it is B already covered. That processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defence of a right or obligation in law, and that it would be, you know, historical and statistical research is a right. Exercising a right that you have. So it was felt that it wasn't necessary really, it was almost a duplication. But when discussing it with the institute and so forth, it's just really a question of clarifying and ensuring that the way V is interpreted includes all of F. But that was really the reason. It was never intended that the regulator would have to give permission in each instance, because it would make their work absolutely impossible. But B was sort of an all-encompassing section, and we've just brought it back.
Roger. Let's go back to the beginning. The definition of processing includes the collection, includes the maintenance of information, the keeping, the holding of information, the storage of information, and that in an environment in which there is an adequacy test. You can only keep the information you need. You don't need it, you get rid of it. Now, those of us who have been involved in academic or research work know basically two things. First of all, that you don't know what you need. You collect information, and on that you build knowledge, and knowledge builds research, and then you move on. And the second thing is that when you do research, you don't know the outcome of your research. If you knew the outcome of your research, it's not research. There is nothing to research if you already found it. So this is not conducive to the academic process. And is somehow reflected in the language itself, which jumps. It jumps from the processing of historical, statistical, and scientific research. The processing of historical, statistical, or scientific research purposes. So the purpose is research for. And the process is extinct. It is extinct. But research comes after the processing. When processing includes collection and storage, you keep to enable research possibly at a later time. It's a facility. It is nothing different from what a library was. History is personal files. It's a library made of collection of personal information. That's how you do history. If somebody is to research, is to write history about all of us, and is to have a file about all of us. And I find this having a chilling effect on perhaps the most important of all our freedoms, which is the academic freedom and the freedom of thought and the freedom of research. So in doubt, I would like to err in giving greater freedom. If it's not enough, we can go back and fix it later. But any restriction of freedom cannot be fixed retroactively.
Yeah. Look, I mean, the way the clause is, it's framed out that the Honourable Dean is deep down a crypto-Calvinist, and the Honourable Jeff is deep down a crypto-Catholic. And when these things come out, I mean, they need to be collected. And then the grand plot that sees the decision-making processes of the South African government could be finally revealed. I mean, this is the type of information which research is made of.
But are the requirements that onerous? Serves the public interest. I mean, that's incredibly wide. I'm going to come back to two. It appears impossible or would involve a disproportionate effort to ask for express consent. Four, guarantees are provided to ensure that the processing doesn't adversely affect the individual privacy of the data subject to a disproportionate extent. And then the main one is that it's necessary. Now, again, even though you say you often conduct research and you don't know why you're conducting it or collating that information, I mean, none of these seem particularly onerous to me.
Yeah,
do you want to jump? The gentleman behind you?
Just like a comment, Mr.
Just
Chairman.
Say who you are, just so that we know whether you're an academic.
My name is Peter Hill from the IT Governance Network, and we provide education and consulting services in this space. We work with international colleagues, strategically from Germany. And I'm just looking at the German legislation here, the Data Protection Act. They talk about making research data anonymous as soon as possible, so that one can protect the identity of individuals. And that's a specific clause that they have here, that they encourage, with these principles, to include that the data should be made anonymous as quickly as possible. They talk about research. The specific section here talks about the personal data should be rendered anonymous as soon as the research purpose permits this.
Yeah, the research purpose.
The fact is that when you're, I mean, just think about genealogy. And I don't know whether that's a field of human endeavor in which has any sex appeal for you, Mr. Chairman, but for some people do. And the field, and where it flourishes is in respect of British genealogy. You can go back into the parishes, and you got this incredible amount of personal information collected in parchments all the way back at times to the 5th century as the Romans lived and began collecting the information. And this continuous about each generation, one after the other. And it's all extremely personal, name, what they did, who they slept with, etc., etc. A religious opinion. Now, Ananda will stand up and says, but they're all dead and they're exempted. Fine. But it is the type of information which makes history. Our lives are becoming much longer. And the entire notion of historical research is becoming very close to chronicles of our days. You get a book written about what happens 3 days, 2 years after it happened, and we've seen it in the negotiation process. So where do you draw the differentiation between history, freedom of research, freedom of opinion, and accessing the personal information of those involved in terms of personal philosophical outlook, religion, etc. I mean, I would rather exempt the organization, quite frankly, rather than the purpose. And I know that Ananda will be very upset about, because it's not within the matrix of the bill. The entire bill is about exempting activities and exempting purposes. But if we could consider exempting entities or qualifying entities, I think we would go farther in addressing the specific concerns.
Yes, I think I would just like to mention that it comes directly from the Netherlands Act, which has been enacted for quite a long time and being used in the Netherlands. I haven't read any sort of criticism on it, except for the word disproportionate, which they felt was too, they would like it to be actually somewhat stricter. So I haven't really read any criticism of this as though it's not working in public, it's not working at being implemented there. I think that if one did not insert it, I think what Dr. Amassini is perhaps suggesting is that B was actually wider, because it just said that if the processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in law, which would then be your right to do historical, statistical, scientific research, and then, you know, there would be, the detail would not be there. But they have specifically requested for to be referred to. Insofar as the organizations are concerned, I wouldn't be in favor of that, because, you know, it would outdate, the bill will become outdated very soon. New organizations come into place and so forth.
Just a question. What would be the problem with just obliging in changing three words into two words and ending to an R? It doesn't seem to be very demanding, is it?
I think for me the issue is was that a serious question? Okay, sorry.
You ruled out that says no, I don't agree, but perhaps if we can get from Ananda, what would really be the harm if that becomes an or for the purposes of the bill?
I don't know what the harm is, because then you with your research would say, no, actually it's impossible, it involves a disproportionate effort to ask for express consent. And then you get away with that ground only, whereas the processing may adversely affect the crypto-Catholic or the crypto, I didn't hear what I was. It might adversely affect us and our individual privacy, and you go
if
off and say, no, but it's too much of an effort.
If you are a subject, Dean, what of historical statistical or scientific research, then hey, your interest, individual as it may be, is overridden by the greater purpose of historical, scientific, of statistical research. I mean, I would be happy with killing statistical and history and science alone. And if I am, if history and science infringes on your little domain or mine, I mean, there is such a thing as the greater good of mankind.
Mario, it's a political question ultimately, and I think a different view as to the role of the state and the whole issue of balancing individual liberties versus and that's the fundamental difference, and it's a political question. But I think that basically to make it a or. And therefore meet any one of these inquiries means, is much too wide. You could need to conduct research into personal information, but you should then try and ensure that safeguards are followed to protect us as much as possible. I mean, that's not asking particularly much. So I think I'm sharing. I can see Ananda's hand, but I think that the issue for me would be. I think that a category of research, that it's correct to have a category of research as you've put back, that simply to say no research is covered by B is if we're debating it to this extent now, it would be then quite unclear what B means. The issue for me would be, should we actually have a rather than putting it under where you've got it, should there not be a specific section on research, so that researchers then can be clear about the whole issue of processing information, and maybe the German aspect of because the issue of storage and destruction of records has come up before. Maybe we should be having a specific clause on research. Might be covered, it might be found elsewhere in the bill, but it might be easier for ease of reading to have a section which just applies to research and repeats those sections. So Ananda, do you want to then, you had your hand up, and can you also respond to that?
Yes, I don't think there will be a problem to have a separate section that can be easily done. I just wanted to refer us back to 8.4 of the EU directive, which says subject to the provision of suitable safeguards, you can have any exemption that you want. So you won't be able to get away with exemptions if you don't put in the safeguards. And I think, for instance, the research serves a public interest. You can never get away from that. So you will have to add that always to everything, because you can't say, It's necessary for my research. It's not in the public interest, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Mr. Chairman, we...
It is a good idea to go for a clause, and because as soon as we do that, we will start drawing the necessary distinctions. I think that Dr. Ambrosini is speaking from the point of view of the humanities, that great, wonderful field of research. But once you're doing scientific or statistical research, it's a different matter. Then no doubt you do want to start de-identifying. Say, for example, someone is doing DNA-based research or medical research drawn from certain diseases that appear in certain families, as we have in South Africa. So then you do want de-identification. So the minute we go into a dedicated clause, we can start drawing those distinctions.
You see, I cringe, and perhaps I come from a different cultural mindset. I know, don't forgive me, you know, we're all free, I'm a child of the French Revolution and the American Declaration of Independence, and when somebody tells me that there is research in the public interest and research which is not in the public interest, and that there's somebody who's going to determine what is in the public interest and what is not in the public interest, you know, any aspect of freedom-aspiring cell I have cringes inside. I don't like legislation which somehow vests within the power of a regulator or anything established by law to determine what type of research is in the public interest. I mean, we're all detracting from the freedom of anyone to research what he or she wants, collect information on the basis of which research can be done at a later time, in the type of notes, etc. And I wouldn't have any problem if the process didn't include a collection, maintenance of personal archives about people, about situations. I just, again, I would hope that one would err on the side of giving greater freedom. If it gets abused and we see pain and then we restrict it, that rather than restricting preemptively, just okay, in case somebody may abuse it.
Okay, but I think the issue is we want to have a separate clause on research and the keeping of records, and I think we can then revisit this debate once that clause is drafted. I think.
Mr. Chair, maybe just to get clarity, please, are we then contemplating a general exemption clause and then a general exemption clause dealing with research purposes?
And then the references to research under 34 would go. So the regulator, well, basically, you should not have to ask the regulator whether you can conduct research. Ananda, you've got your hair covering your. You happy with that? Okay. Can we have, and I'm sure one of the members at least needs to go and get a fix. Well, she's not smoking anymore. Okay, she's not smoking anymore. Can we have a brief break? Can we have, because we're not that many people, can we break for 10 minutes, please?